welcome to the Advent Iron podcast. This edition is Mike Gillespie talking to Rowena Fielding about privacy, data protection and InfoSec.
Most people, certainly in the UK, I mean, tech literacy is so low. Most people think that computers are full of like magic elves or something, and it's all black magic and completely random and inexplicable. And so they just throw it over the fence and go to the IT people, there you go, magic wizards, fix that, and then spend all their time complaining about how crap their wizards are.
And I think I've seen that, actually. I've seen that whole journey. Having been somebody who entered the IT profession, I use the term loosely, in the late 80s, having been, you know, a hobbyist, I was one of those kids who had all of those early computers in his bedroom. I was one of those kids who was hacking games because I wanted to make the game do something that the game didn't do. And that's how I learnt my IT skills. As somebody who was probably one of the first generation to do computers at school, where we were taught coding and a whole range of other things. We were punch card coding and, you know, COBOL and BASIC and languages like that. To then see later generations where computer studies had basically deteriorated into this is how you use Microsoft Office.
That was my experience.
This is how you use
IT
a spreadsheet. That's become IT at school. And that's turned a whole generation off to a whole range of other stuff that is technology. But more importantly, what we haven't done in 30 years is we haven't wrapped any sort of education around the stuff that we're really passionate about, the security, the privacy. All of those concepts have been completely lost in the immersion of the technology. And you imagine, you know, going back to sort of the 80s, and let's not, because the fashion was quite awful. Music was all right, but the fashion was awful. But if you went back to the 80s and somebody would say to you, in one go, what we're going to do as a government is we're going to make all of our citizens carry a device. And that device is going to be always tracking you. Everywhere you go, every route you take, everywhere you stop, it'll have a little beacon on it, and it'll tell us that you're in this shop or that bar or that cafe.
Everyone you talk to, what you say, how often you say it to them, what you buy, what you look at.
And then what we want you to do is, whenever two or more of you gather in a public place, you have to check in and tell us where you are and who you're with. Tag everyone who's there with you so we know who's with you. And in your home, we're going to put devices that are always watching you and always listening to you. But we'll call them entertainment. We'll call them entertainment. Yeah. So don't worry about it. Now, you imagine if somebody had put that on the table in one package, that, you know, you just wouldn't, would you? And yet, in 2019, we're in a world where there's more intelligence and more analytics about us in private hands, in the hands of social media companies and technology companies, than there's ever going to be in the hands of governments and intelligence agencies.
Well, in the hands of corporate translates to in the hands of government, because the people that write laws that say we can go and dig into any of this.
Yeah, but it's the technology company, the private sector, who are collecting the data in the first place. And they are, you know, we have legislation around what government is allowed to do.
Oh, indeed.
Albeit legislation written by government to allow government to do what it wants
to do. Which they ignore anyway.
But that legislation doesn't cover much of the exploitation that occurs by the social media companies.
Or rather it does, it's just not enforced. Says the data protection law advocate sitting in the corner. I mean, I think in terms of IT education, the development of the graphical user interface was both the best and the worst thing that could happen to humanity's relationship with technology, because it fostered the illusion that this stuff is simple. By simplifying it to the end user can do an awful lot of activity stuff with no understanding or idea of the insane complexity at the back end, which means they can pack more into their day, but which means they're not equipped to be able to identify errors correctly. So lots of time wasted on help desk from people who don't know the difference between the hard drive and the monitor, for example. And people innovate using reusable tools at the drop of a hat. But the more innovation that's built on top of that, the less understanding there is across the whole technical community of the underlying infrastructures, dependencies, complexities. So now you have, for example, web designers who focus wholly on the look and feel and the search engine optimization, and actually don't have any idea at all that the components they're using are really, really hostile to individual rights and freedoms. They're just bung it in there because, A, it's what everybody uses, it's what they're used to, and it looks nice. So by masking the complexity, we've fostered a trust in technology that is totally misplaced. And I think more kids should read dystopian sci-fi. That's what I think.
I'm totally with you there. I think that should be an integral part of the curriculum, actually. As somebody who cut his teeth on science fiction, and I was a big science fiction reader, and I've seen a lot of the stuff that was science fiction 30 years ago come to pass.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I think sometimes we forget how quickly things have changed as well. We think that, you know, at the turn of the millennium, it would still be another 5 years before Facebook hit our desks. And that's how short space things have happened in. But at the same time, has the professional element of it progressed with the change in our environment, the change in our culture, and the emerging technology?
God, no. I think no, absolutely not. I think we're developing technological advancement faster than our, you know, hardwired biological evolutionary capability can keep up with. So we've made tools that we can't possibly use safely, ethically, respectfully, because we're all using them at such a fast rate. You know, you think about how many times you interact with technology on a daily basis. If you had to stop and understand all of that technology before you were able to use it, you'd never get anything done. So in order to get things done, we're just pushing a lot of problems under the rug. And human nature being what it is, there's always going to be problems with how we relate to each other, how we affect each other. Technology has allowed us to magnify and exacerbate those issues to incredible levels where, you know, one person can make a tweet, say, that's an off-colour, tasteless, rather reprehensible joke. And then by the end of the week, they will have had 30 million hate messages and death threats. They'll have lost their job, their social media. They'll have to shut down their social media. I mean, being able to affect other people at scale is a really dangerous thing. Mm. And our little brains haven't really caught up with the implications of that.
The thing that I notice is just the absolute volume of information that is created on a daily basis, even just within one workplace, the amount of information that users are expected to get to grips with. Now, when I entered the workplace, you kind of knew what information you had because you could see it.
Mm.
It was tangible and you could touch it.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew when you had too much because your drawer didn't close anymore. You know, and in some cases, information had been sitting around in the office long enough you could even smell it. And I sometimes think that what we've actually done with the development of our technology, and as you say, that devolved accountability for all of this to the IT department, is we've also completely lost touch with the information itself. So we no longer know what we've got or why we've got it, let alone how much of it there is.
I think, this century, the key differentiator for success, both individually and corporately, is going to be knowledge management. Not information management, knowledge management. I mean, the average worker, they come into a new job, for example, and on that first day they get given a stack of impenetrable corporate policies, which they're expected to memorise right there and then and be able to flexibly apply to every possible scenario in the future, which is nonsense. But just everything they have to do has somewhere, somehow, been refined into a discipline so nuanced and intricate that it's actually impossible to do any one thing right these days. So kind of everybody's skating over the surface and doing everything wrong, because doing anything right takes a full-time job. We know too much, and we don't have the flexibility or the capability in real time to be able to review all of that information, decide what's useful and how useful it is, and where and how to use it. So, for example, classic kind of workplace information management is things like nested folder structures. Now, we live in an age where information exists in a mesh. You know, that there are not hierarchical relationships between bits of information, only in very simplistic cases. We need information to be interrelated. We need to be able to navigate to what we need at that moment in time in a context, instead of having to gulp down this entire hierarchy and pick the bits out. So I think we need to, and the IT industry is very much guilty of propagating this linear hierarchical thinking, which is nothing like the real world. So things like workplace wikis instead of, you know, nested folders on SharePoint for flexible information navigation is going to be so important. But that is a discipline. Knowledge management is a discipline in itself. It's a full-time job, and no one wants to invest in that right now. So everyone's drowning in a sea of information, some of which is useful and relevant and some of which is just noise. And no one's got the time to do anything about it. And then it becomes IT's problem. All they want to do is shrink everyone's mailbox sizes and get the servers running sweetly again. Or IT go, oh, we need to delete this J drive that's a company-wide share that people have been contributing to for the past decade. And everybody goes, oh, no, there might be something useful on there. But they can't take the time to go and weed it out, because the entire workplace and business process have evolved to make that assumption that information and technology and knowledge just kind of take care of themselves with magic elves in the basement. So that's not sustainable. And it goes to the fake news problem at the moment as well. When there are so many sources of information all saying completely different things, people just fall back on their prejudices and bias to decide what's right. And it's kind of the same with these big stashes of information in the workplace as well.
And I think that quite often hear the phrase that organisations are drowning in data but completely starved of insight.
Yes.
I think that is both an online and an offline problem. You know, we quite often find when we're working with organisations that there are whole archives of paper documents, and the same logic applies. Don't get rid of it, because we don't know what's in there, but there might be something useful. And organisations aren't prepared to invest the time to find out what the useful bits are.
Yes, that's exactly right. They don't even have the time to ask the question, does it spark joy?
And, you know, that's a security problem for people like us, but surely that's a massive data protection problem as well.
It is, both in a sort of compliance with law sense, but also in an out-in-the-real-world sense. So on the law side, you know, the law says you must only process the personal data for as long as you need it for the purpose that it was originally collected, or subsequent ones you've decided on fairly and lawfully and transparently. So there's automatically, a compliance issue there. But in the abstract, you know, nobody really cares about that. What actually happens is that when information is hoarded like that, eventually it probably will be reused. Whether or not it's adequate or relevant or fair or even accurate, or even worse, information that does need to be used is not used.
Yeah.
Records that might assist somebody in getting support provisions that they need, or extenuating circumstances that indicate why a one-size-fits-all policy has to be a bit flexible in this case. It's all just been chucked into this big pond of information, and as you say, it's not being used. It's not. I saw a wonderful cartoon. I think it was on LinkedIn. with an article about, you know, getting a proper handle on information knowledge management, and the title is "Somebody's been peeing in my data lake." But that's the thing, when somebody pees in your data lake, you don't know what's pee and what's not.
Ooh. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why we wanted to have Rowena along today. That one gem.
I didn't come up with that. I'm only repeating it. But actually, it's a good analogy, because then you recognise the fact that you have to have filtration and water safety units between the lake and the end user. And that is where businesses, most SMEs, are not investing in that kind of filtration. They might be buying an a tool that does, you know, heuristic analysis or something, but there is no substitute for the Mark I human brain when it comes to contextual information, deciding what's useful and what's not. That is going to be the 21st century business discipline, and it's not even in its infancy yet. It's not even in embryo form yet. I think it's yet to be really conceived in the marketplace. And that is super, super exciting, because you need to have an understanding of business, of technology, but most of all, of psychology. Mm. And the psychology part has been missing from much of technology since its inception. The only place it's actively being used is in marketing and advertising, where quite a lot often it's being used for evil rather than good. We need to take that back, I think.
So you've used the term discipline a couple of times there. And, you know, the scenario that I've spoken a lot about over the last few years is the profession, the professional side of things. Is there a fundamental need, do you think, for us to completely rethink the direction we're going in as professionals? And rather than seeing records management and archive, data protection, information security, risk management, and all these other areas that people are practicing in as individual disciplines, to actually see them first and foremost as a core body of knowledge that we, you know, we should all be learning, and then allow people to move into a specialism. So the analogy I quite often use is, if you look at medicine,
I was just about to make
you don't
the exact
enter
same
medical
analogy.
School, yeah. And on the first day of medical school, get told you're going to be a neurosurgeon.
Mm.
You learn to be a doctor first and foremost, and you learn about anatomy and physiology and parasitology and a whole range of things
at a very surface level.
At a very surface level. Yeah. Surely the you know, the profession of the future, we should have people who are, yes, you know, once you're senior in information security or IT security or data protection, you're very specialised and knowledgeable in that area, but also to have previously learned all those other areas, to understand that they have this overlapping and interlinking ecosystem with each other.
I totally agree with the sense of what you're saying. I think that would actually be a lifetime's work, and so you wouldn't actually be ready for the workplace until you were well into your 50s, which is goes back to what I was saying earlier about we know so much about so much stuff, and we've got so many sophisticated models and frameworks and metrics and yada yada for all these things. To learn, you know, all of them, even at the surface, it's just impossible. So I think really my view is that we should be redesigning education so that it's not about learning the concepts and then launching people at them. It's about fostering critical thinking skills, rational analysis, understanding of statistics, understanding of psychology, sociology, human communication and behaviour, and then having the information architectures to provide contextualised, just-in-time information as and when it's needed. Because otherwise I don't see how we're going to cope. I mean, I started in IT, and then I went into IT security, and then I went into data protection. And to reach the level of nerd I am now, basically was because I just didn't have a social life for 10 years. I just spent all my time doing this stuff. That's not really healthy, and it's not what we should be expecting from people. But it took that to stuff the amount of knowledge that is sitting in my head. And then I still, you know, forget most of it from day to day. So I think we should rethink the direction we're going in completely. Actually, I don't think we have a direction right now. I think we should come up with a direction. That direction being equipping people with the skills to be able to design and use the information systems that will help them, or at least provide useful specs to the people who do the design, mm-hmm. instead of like sauntering in and going, I want a magic box, okay, thanks, bye.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, buy my magic beans, it's going to magically make you compliant with all legislation immediately.
Mm-hmm. And the people who I most respect in the privacy industry are mostly people who didn't start off by thinking, I'm going to be a data protection expert at, you know, school leaving age or whatever. They've done something else, and then they've used their life experience and the skills that they brought up, and they've translated that into this area. And actually, the people whose expertise is not up to the same level, they're the people who kind of have done the sort of a set path of these are the certifications you must take, these are the things you must learn. They've learnt a lot, but applying it is not quite the same thing. And I think it's very much the same with InfoSec. Certainly from a coding point of view, I should add here that I am the world's most inept coder. I don't have the right kind of brain. If you learn to be able to lay out the flow of your thinking, the inputs, the outputs, the conditions, the logic, then you can learn any language and express yourself in that language. And I think it's the same with the general information governance. Actually, I really hate that phrase, but in the absence of anything better, that's what I'll use. Information governance areas, being able to define the problem, understand and unpick the possible solutions, and then stitch them together into something that works. That is worth more than any amount of professional qualifications or time spent in the study lab, or, you know, being able to recite however many clauses of whichever legislation, she says guiltily.
I think it's okay to be able to recite the clauses.
Oh, that's all right then.
I do agree with you that you then also have to have a degree of common sense about how that applies in the real world.
Common sense.
And I think sometimes we forget that good quality application of the rules also has to be balanced with professional judgment, pragmatism, and common sense.
Yes.
And I think some of the areas that I see a lot where data protection is used as a reason not to do something actually flies in the face of common sense.
Oh, totally.
And as you said, you know, not using the information to provide good quality healthcare, yeah, or to provide a service to somebody, or to protect somebody from antisocial behaviour. Or if you look at all the time social services and the police have been held to account where something has gone wrong, most of those times the information existed, but either the security prevented or the culture prevented, mm-hmm. the sharing and, if I can use this word in a very positive way, the exploitation of that information for the right reasons.
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, one of the reasons why I love the field of data protection, and you could never, ever pay me enough to go back to InfoSec, is a controversial opinion coming up here, by the way. Data protection has a point to it. It's human rights and freedoms. It's protecting people from other people. Not to the extent of elevating the individual above the rest of society, because you cannot pander to absolutely everybody all of the time. We have collective responsibilities as well as individual rights and freedoms. But if any data protection question, forget the law for the first question. Think human rights and freedoms. Ask the questions about that. And then the legal aspect kind of take care of themselves.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, InfoSec feels now to me, looking back, like endless navel gazing. Because you can't human-proof humans. And no matter how much technology or process you throw at it, you just can't make anything secure. Well, like, what even is secure? It is a degree of risk management. And even with the best of good faith, the best policies, the most effectively deployed technology, you still can't say with 100% confidence, we will never have a breach, we've never had a breach. It's always going to happen. And just the futility of the whole thing made me really depressed. But with data protection, you're not just protecting your employer's corporate interests. You're actually trying to, I don't want to say make a better world because that sounds really soppy, but there is more of an end game in sight than constantly maintaining this state of fragile equilibrium. Actually, this is more about real people, real lives, real circumstances, and you know, being able to improve those in some slight way. Problem is, that's not really a very profitable thing to do, which is why most people don't really want to do it.
I think speaking as a career naval gazer, and as somebody who really got into a career of InfoSec before the computer had made it mainstream, and I think that's part of the challenge, actually, is that InfoSec has become too much about the sec part, and we're worried about the security, which tends to focus purely on confidentiality.
Oh, yeah.
But actually, InfoSec is about, in my opinion, InfoSec is about everything that we talk about when we talk about data protection. It's having information for a genuine reason, knowing what that reason is and using it for that reason, enabling people to use it for that reason. So getting information to the right people at the point of need, making sure information is accurate and up-to-date and trustworthy. I think all of the principles of data protection, actually, if you take the personal information element out of it and apply it in an InfoSec world, it applies as much to corporate information as it does to personal information. I think if we use data protection much more as a business tool rather than as a fear factor or as a stick to beat organisations into compliance with, or as a pure let's tick the box for data protection type methodology, then InfoSec would benefit from that as well.
I don't disagree with what you just said there. The whole crossover between InfoSec and data protection is something that I rant on about a lot, because while there is a large degree of crossover, there are also things in data protection that aren't even on InfoSec's radar. Things like data subject rights, fairness, lawfulness, transparency, stuff that really goes right to the human rights aspect and the rights and freedoms, which just is completely outside the scope of InfoSec thinking. So I think there's a real danger in even giving the impression that one is conflating the two, because the really important bits get lost. I mean, you can have the right information in the right systems, it's accurate, it's up to date, it's reliable, the right people can access it, it's being used for good. But if you haven't told the data subject that you are in some way affecting their life and give them, you know, the right to see what's going on and make decisions about it, then you failed at data protection.
Yeah.
So, and I think I agree with you with the everybody thinking it's about confidentiality and then going back to sleep is a massive, massive problem. And I find this in discussions with IT people all the time. I say data protection, they say encryption passwords.
Yes.
And I say, no, human rights and human freedoms. And they go, oh, yes, blockchain.
And what I quite often see is the IT people then, they want to protect the data to do data protection.
Yeah.
And this is the challenge all the time. You know, you look at, you know, even major national systems that are designed to allow information to be accessed and used for the public good, then the security people get involved and make it almost unusable.
That's, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that's probably because they've been brought in at the very last minute and not had the by design opportunities that if they had been included earlier on in the process, then it could have been designed with security as the path of least resistance.
I think we'll now turn this one into a soundbite. A data protection person actually standing up for security people.
A rehabilitated information security person. A reformed character.
do actually think that there's enough collaboration between all of the disciplines.
There's never enough collaboration, actually, in any between any two or more given disciplines. Mm. And again, that comes back to that issue of hyper-specialisation. We have to focus so hard on getting our little bits right. We don't really have the cognitive bandwidth, let alone the time or the energy, to be able to integrate and collaborate with other people. I think the expectations being placed on information governance professionals are so vastly in excess of human capabilities that I'm not sure whether the collaboration is the answer, but it's always an improvement. I mean, my idea of a good meeting is a bunch of people sitting around a table in a pub having a free-form chat. You get so much more done and so many good ideas and you know, real action points from that than you do with, you know, six people on a conference call or yeah. people sitting around a table with a fixed agenda and fixed times and fixed places in the organisational hierarchy and all the stuff that goes with that. So, like with the changing our information management structures from linear and hierarchical to sort of free-form association, I think we should be doing the same with organisational cultures. Mm. And we're not working in Victorian mills anymore. We're not sending people down mines because they're the underclass of society and we can do what we want to them. The whole idea of human rights being that, you know, we're all equal in rights and freedoms. But corporate culture really hasn't caught on with that. You need leadership, you need accountability, but you don't need to straitjacket people into these roles. So yes, collaboration, but collaboration is organic. You can't stick a bunch of people with certain titles in a room with pens and paper and then be like, right, collaborate.
I suppose it's that straitjacketing that I was getting at earlier when I was saying about getting people to learn this sort of core body of knowledge. Is we have this inverted pyramid system at the moment where people are just put into straight into a role without knowing anything about other roles. I mean, you and I are different, and we know plenty of people like ourselves who are different, but we're different by accident, not by design. You know, I started off doing information management and to a degree data protection in a medical environment. Mm-hmm. Because that was the important thing in the job that I had at that point in time. So I learned the value of information, the need for good quality retention and records management, the value of protecting personal information within a medical environment as skills, yeah. Way before I started then, and purely by accident, got funneled into IT because technology was starting to become mainstream, which then got me into ITSEC and InfoSec and all the other stuff that I've done over the years. Mm. And, you know, you've had an opposite path. But that's by accident. Mm. We don't have a system that allows people to have a good baseline level of skills in a whole range of areas. Mm. And even in IT security, what we see, you know, a talented 17-year-old being singled out and being, oh, you're quite good at coding and you've got a good knowledge of systems, you're going to be a pen tester. When actually maybe they should be a security professional who eventually specialises in pen testing.
Welcome to your cage.
Yeah, welcome to your cage, absolutely. Yeah,
I think that's right. And I have a cousin who is now a GP, but when she was training, she had to do, you know, different positions in different hospital wards and stuff like that. I have to say, though, that the medical profession is every bit as siloed as the information technology profession and the legal profession, and because that's it's a natural outcome of hyper-specialisation, yeah. again. But, yeah, I agree that having a sort of foundation skill set built up is much, much more useful. But the question is, you know, who's going to pay for that? Mm. The education system at the moment, certainly in this country, is geared towards schools' league tables and exam results, not outcomes for individual pupils. Universities are being starved of funding. They have to bring in more money, which means they design courses to be sold, not to educate, you know, the next generations. And I'm speaking in very general terms here. I'm not saying everybody does this all the time, but this is the trend I'm seeing. And then employers want to hire a ready-made outline of that fits the gap in their organisation. They don't want to pay to train people. They certainly don't want to let them give up their time to go and do professional development. You know, trying to justify any kind of training as a business expense, I'm sure, is is a painful process many people have been through. And if it's not, you know, if it's not clearly associated with some kind of point and click action you do in the day, then yeah, good luck to you on that. So it does require a rethink, but it also requires investment, and we're not really in a very terribly good position for that sort of thing right now. It's kind of relying on, you know, people who do stuff voluntary, people who write blogs, people who go and give workshops, people who, you know, are nice and do podcasts, for example. That's not really professionalisation, though.
Absolutely.
So,
Do you think we actually owe it to the next generation, as the current generation of professionals, to actually be getting together and make that change happen?
Well, I'm very literal-minded and very pedantic, so I don't think we owe it in any sense, but I think it would be very, very silly of us not to, for our own self-interest, even setting aside the whole, you know, service to humanity thing, because these are the people who are going to have to look after us when we can't do stuff anymore, and these are the people that are going to, you know, be building the world we're going to be living in the future, because you know, longevity is increasing, but quality of life, not so much.
And so, the people who are going to be protecting and managing our personal information in the future as well.
Well, and, or not, yes.
Yeah.
Indeed. So I think we have a responsibility to society in general, but I think we have a healthy dose of self-interest as well. Because right now I look around at the way information about people is being used, and I see far more hostile, abusive, disadvantageous, cutthroat practice, completely devoid of any empathy or social responsibility, than I see the opposite. I think we really, really need to change that thinking. Otherwise, we're all just going to dystopia ourselves into extinction, really.
No, I think without doubt what we've seen over the last 30 years is a very gradual but definite erosion of the concept of individual rights, individual privacy, individual fundamental rights and freedoms. And I think that there are corporations and governments out there now that just believe that they have the right to treat us and our information any way they want to.
I don't think there's been an increase. I think looking at who that is brings slight significance. So, for example, if a tiny country somewhere that isn't highly technologically developed thinks like that, then, you know, kind of, it doesn't really matter to the rest of us. But the platforms and the technologies we use really are coming out of America and China. America does not have any concept of human rights. They have citizens' rights. So if you're not a citizen, there's a limit to how much protection of law and government and social responsibility is due to you. And China obviously is a sort of hybrid capitalist communist sort of arrangement. But the traditional cultural approach in that society for thousands of years has been that the individual is secondary to the family, to society. So we've got these ideas about what human rights and freedoms should be, and they're very European ideas. And we're looking around and we're thinking everybody else should do it the same. Because we're right, obviously.
A very modern-day missionary approach.
Yes, indeed. But the the rails on which the world is running have been developed under completely different philosophies. Mm. And so there's a massive sort of philosophical cultural clash going on. And that's not so easily resolved. I think actually these days people are more aware, certainly in Europe, and starting to get so in America, the more aware of individual rights and freedoms. But at the same time, there's a pushback as well against elevating the individual over the rest of society. Yeah. Because, you know, we recognise that we're sort of all in this together. No man is an island and all that. Mm-hmm. We need each other to be able to survive. And so some degree of consideration for each other needs to be applied. And the big sort of tech giant platforms, your Facebooks, your Ubers, your equally unsavoury characters, they have been designed, implemented and marketed under completely different philosophies. I don't think that's sustainable. I think they're finding out that's not sustainable. Mm. But also think there's such polarisation in opinions. For me, the universe is a constantly shifting, very delicate equilibrium. Everything is an equilibrium. Whereas you've got people who actually believe that it's either this way or that way. And if you go this way, then you're all evil and don't deserve to be, you know, rescued. And if you go that way, then you're all perfect and you can do nothing wrong. And that's just nonsense. So again, it all comes back to human nature is our biggest barrier to making effective use of technology.
So the million-dollar question today then. With so many breaches of personal information and highly publicised breaches of personal information over the last few years, is it actually possible now to put the privacy Pandora back in the box?
Oh, there's a question for which it depends is the only answer. For individuals whose personal data has been leaked and is now in probably many hundreds of hands, a degree of which will be unsavoury, they will never be able to unbreach their information. They will be at risk for the rest of their lives. It might be minor risk. They might get more spam. It might be major risk. For example, in some countries where perhaps being homosexual is illegal and punishable by death, if somebody's sexuality is leaked in a data set, that person's going to need to move, yeah. Otherwise they will die. So you can't unshare information. It's infinitely reproducible. And because of that, there's very, very little opportunity to trace any given use back to any given source. Which is why we have legislation that says to organisations, you need to be better about this. And even if the information is out there just lying around, you're not allowed to touch it unless you've got a legitimate purpose, a lawful basis, that it's information you need in order to do your legitimate thing. You've told people what you're doing. You're doing it in a way that respects their rights and freedoms. So I don't agree with the statement that privacy is dead, we should all just give up and share everything all the time, because privacy is the core of human autonomy and dignity. And I don't really want to live in a world where those things are not considered important. For the individual, the risk is out of their control now. So you can understand them kind of sitting back and being apathetic and going, well, I can't do anything about it now. As soon as something does happen, they'll be up in arms.
Yeah.
But that's human nature. We don't really do risk management very well as a species. Our lizard hind brains are far more in control than we think they are. So I don't think that the whole Pandora's box analogy is interesting, because the last thing left in the box was hope. And I think the hope comes from being able to recognise the challenges and deal with those challenges through legislation and enforcement of that legislation, through cultural principles, through communication, and through just the idea of human rights, human freedoms, human dignity, human autonomy, no matter how much you may dislike the actual individuals, and I say this as a professional misanthropologist. There is hope still left in the box. In the whole history of... you've started me off on a whole nother rant topic, but in the whole history of society, new stuff comes along, people exploit the hell out of it and damage each other. That's reined in. Cultural acceptance of that reining in follows. New technology, exploit the hell out of it, damage each other, gets reined in, cultural acceptance. It was the same with the invention of electricity. It was the same with the invention of the motor car. And now it's information platforms. So, yeah, I think the pendulum will swing back the other way. Unfortunately, humans being what they are, a lot of people will have their lives wrecked and ruined in that journey. I just hope I'm not one of them.
Well, I always think it's very useful to finish a podcast on hope. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Rowena Fielding, and I'm sure you'll agree, we could have had this conversation going for hours yet. So thank you very much, Rowena. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. It's been fun.